Thanks, Bruce, very much for the invitation for organizing this. Hopefully the title isn't the only reason to cite a paper, but it does help it stick in the mind. Well, it's a real honor to be here to talk about Pema Monteith, primarily, especially 50 years after John Monteith published his 1965 paper. And today I'm going to give some history, also give from a kind of a mechanical engineering viewpoint, you know, as we do in estimating water requirements and depletions, what the Monteith, Pema Monteith is quite useful for, and maybe some of its limitations. Just all of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Pema Monteith and Penman. What Monteith did in 65 is he took the 48 Penman equation. It really did not alter the combination equation because that's a theoretical basis, but he replaced the wind function, the empirical wind function shown on the top there, with a electrical analog for aerodynamic resistance. Then he also did insert the surface resistance term, a bulk term representing a single layer, so a fairly simple model. Some people call it the big leaf model. Assumes the entire surface is fairly homogeneous as far as stomatal resistance and transfers go. as we'll see with the Pema Monteith, and as we all know, it really includes all the components that have the biggest impact on ET, the net radiation that provides the energy. We discount that for any conductance into the soil, G, and then humidity, temperature, and wind speed are all present. Just a quick analogy. One of my favorite painters is Van Gogh, and there's a lot of similarities between Van Gogh and Monteith. They both were pioneers, very inventive. They could see how things worked, and I think based on this painting by Van Gogh, both of them could see eddies, which is a rare thing to actually see them. Some of us just have to resort to soap bubbles. I often, when we teach a short course in remote sensing of ET, I march all the participants out, and we give them each a bottle of a 50-cent bottle of soap bubbles, and have them stand there blowing soap bubbles. And that's one great way to appreciate eddy transport and diffusivity, is to watch these soap bubbles moving around. Well, for that RS term in the Pema Monteith, there's a number of ways to break that down and then try to reassemble it. Generally, the desire is to keep this method as simple as possible, especially in the engineering water resources communities, and for just operational application. So over on the upper right, that B term is probably the primary and traditional way, and that was the primary form that Monteith used, where we just have the aerodynamic resistance in parallel with the surface resistance. But if one looks more closely at surface resistance and does want to break it down, to be really correct, one needs to do a pretty good simulation of soil, and there really are four different opportunities or conditions for the soil. Under partial wetting, like we might see in irrigation, we can have wet soil versus dry soil, and then each of those we can break down into what's shaded and what's in full sunlight in a really good, robust two-source model. It's really almost a five-source model. I'm not going to get into the biophysical part of the resistance, just to say that there are a couple old, but I still think widely used ways of trying to parameterize surface resistance as a function of conductance, G, the old Jarvis-Stewart model, where terms of the amount of leaf area present, of course, and then the amount of sunlight that might cause some activation of stomates. VPD, which Monteith later argued that rather than VPD, we ought to be talking just about flux and the ability of the plant to keep up fluxing, and then temperature and soil moisture availability. Jarvis used a multiplicative model. Price and Black used a minimization. Just a short example in two locations. One, some grass lysimeter data that we collected at Logan, Utah, and then some data from Bill Pruitt. This is that G function of Jarvis, where all of those upper lines are the individual terms, and if we multiply them together, we get this lower term. So even though in a place like Logan and Davis, where we've got a lot of sunshine and optimal temperature here in August, they're all at fairly high values, but when you multiply them together, it suggests a discounting of almost 50% in the Pima Monteith. So that's one of the challenges of the Pima Monteith, is to get this type of parameterization and estimation correct. If we take that G function and put it back into the Pima Monteith, we can see that we can get very good agreement with lysimeter data here, even during the nighttime. Here in Logan, I picked this day because it was a day that a cloud came over, and we can see that function does fairly well. Of course, we're just talking about grass, which is a fairly simple surface to estimate. But the Pima Monteith, it's all there. The physics are all there, and it does a nice job. Of course, and I'll mention this a little bit later, but one can estimate ET if one has surface temperature now. One does not need the evaporation term of the Pima Monteith, and one can just strictly estimate sensible heat flux. Then you don't have to worry about the stomatal conductance and bulk surface conductance. But you do have to measure surface temperature, which Apogee is very happy to assist us with. But we just don't see it spread out, except by satellite, of course. We can do something similar. And in fact, a lot of the energy balance models used for remote sensing from satellite and UAV data do use surface temperature, so we don't need that conductance. Some of the primary uses of the Pima Monteith, probably the one that it's most well known for and operationally utilized for now, and I'll talk about that more, is the reference ET, used as a basis, and then we multiply that by a crop coefficient to get a potential actual ET. And then in hydrology, the Pima Monteith is found quite a home, and in irrigation. And then some forms of the Pima Monteith kind of give the basis for some of our multi-layer models, like the Shuttleworth-Wallace, one of the earlier models. You can see the Pima Monteith existing inside some of those layers. Well, let's talk about reference ET. By definition, reference ET is just the ET from some well-defined surface that's got adequate soil water to support near maximum evapotranspiration, and it can tell us what the impact of the weather-based variability is on the ET rate. And the beauty of the Pima Monteith is it's a physically based equation. If we didn't have reference ET, and it's been around probably the last 35, 40 years, we would have to have a unique equation and calibration for every crop type and every row density and every stage of growth, which can be done, but it gets very messy, and for the majority of the practicing community, it's just more complication than what they would like to have. So the reference ET method is simple, it breaks things down, and it's quite reproducible. I want to make a bold statement, and I want to say I'm very much a fan of the Pima Monteith, and I use it every day. But there are some limitations that we should understand, and I think Bob Lascano will talk about this some too. One of these is that, in the derivation of the Pima equation, and then it lingers in the Pima Monteith, is the assumption that we can estimate surface temperature as equal to air temperature if we just use the strict delta calculation. And there's a reason for that. Penman derived the Penman equation, as the story goes, to estimate soil moisture in France in preparation for D-Day. The Allies wanted to know if the tanks would sink in the mud or if they'd be able to advance once they hit the beachheads. So he had to use just air temperature and air parameters. Nobody was measuring surface temperature in those days. The other thing is that the Pima teeth, because of that single bulk surface resistance, probably should be limited to a surface that can be characterized as kind of a single type of surface with a single type of value for surface resistance. And that kind of takes us to that reference surface, say in the case of grass or alfalfa, where we have full ground cover, no exposed soil. And one of the reasons I've listed four very important reasons why surface temperature is a big part of Pima Monteith, or should be. One is in the calculation of delta, which is trying to extrapolate from temperature and vapor at some reference measurement height down to the surface. And if we only use air temperature, we're not going to get the appropriate slope for that if the surface temperature is very different from air temperature. Then another big gorilla is outgoing long wave. A cool surface is going to emit at T to the fourth power. And a lot of times our evaporating surfaces can be 30 degrees Celsius cooler than a surface of, say, with very little evaporation. And so we can see a 100 watts difference in net long wave between a wet surface and a dry surface. 100 watts, that's a lot of evapotranspiration estimation. And then, of course, if we've got a dry surface, we've got a lot of buoyancy. It's important to at least consider that. And then soil heat flux, as we know, the higher the temperature, probably the stronger the gradient and the higher the G-term. So this probably precludes applying the Pima Monteith directly or easily in desert regions or in just dry rain-fed systems. And I'm just throwing out some numbers just to get things started, I guess. But, you know, if we're less than probably 70% of reference ET, we probably should rethink applying the Pima Monteith, or at least pay it in its original single form, without going and estimating surface temperature. So how does one do it? Well, one can go through those four parameters and just iterate for the surface temperature term. In manual 70 update that I'll talk about, we're calling this procedure AFib, for just lack of a better algorithm, aerodynamic fluxes via iterative energy balance. I thought AFib might be something to remember if you got an irregular heartbeat. Think of it. Maybe you get that excited when you're doing ET that you do get an AFib. So here's the AFib method. It's just the original aerodynamic equations. We start off with net radiation and soil heat flux. Here we're estimating soil heat flux as a function of both net radiation and H, kind of taking off from some suggestions by Broussard and Skull. And then there's the straight aerodynamic equation for evaporation, latent heat of evaporation. And we can see both the aerodynamic and bulk surface resistance, in this case in series. And then we calculate, knowing a first estimate of this, and we start just by estimating neutrality so that H is zero. Make an estimate by inverting the sensible heat equation, but in this case, substituting in for H, Rn minus G minus Le. And then taking a stab at aerodynamic resistance using some of the stability correction parameters, and then just repeating until the whole thing gets stabilized. And there can be some variance on this, but basically after 5, 6, 7 iterations, we can get a good estimate. And you can create these equations from the Pima Monteith by just reverting it to its original form. I mean, these are the equations you use to derive the Pima Monteith, and you just make that estimate over on the right that delta is a function of air temperature and make some replacements. Well, let me give you an example of some of the impact of the sensitivity to not estimating for surface temperature. This is some data from Balanced Rock, south central Idaho. Can't see it very well, but out behind Balanced Rock is a nice big plain of sagebrush that we set up a weather station, full-bodied weather station for a couple years. In fact, you have a Kearsgård sitting here in the second row help set up and manage that station. Here's our estimated net radiation, and then over here in this column is the net radiation for the reference surface, either grass or alfalfa. And like I was mentioning, you can see it's 100 watts on average or more stronger than the actual net radiation due to that difference in long wave. We can see a fairly strong soil heat flux in the desert. And we can see here 15, 16 or more, even 20 degrees difference between air temperature measured and then measured surface temperature. And here's an iterative using that AFib. We can get fairly close between estimated and measured surface temperature. If we can see then, if we only use air temperature for the delta versus using air temperature and surface temperature, we can see as much as 50% difference in the value. So it does make an impact. Can you hear me okay, by the way? Is this loud enough? It's okay? Okay. Keep close? Okay. And then I wanted to just go through, over on the left-hand side is some estimates for that seven-day period, from the AFib method. And again, it's sagebrush during a drying period, so we can see the LE reducing. And then here's if we just use the original singular Pema Monteith, and I used a conductance function for the sagebrush. I think it was approaching a couple thousand seconds per meter. So these are estimates. But we can, you know, we can see about, well, here's the percent difference, up to 20-30% difference in our ET estimate. Now, if we just improve our estimate of G, we can bring down the percent difference. But then if we calculate delta in the correct way, as one would say, and keep that better estimate of G, we actually overestimate more. So if you only take care of surface temperature to be used in delta, you actually might exacerbate the differences. And it isn't until over here on the right when we bring in all parameters, that should be a xi there. I just threw away my xi Greek character. But anyway, here's this. We're using stability, RL out, delta, G, all as a function of surface temperature. Then from the AFib, we're averaging close to, well, within 5%. And a lot of that is just due to differences in linearity between the Pema Monteith and the AFib method. Okay, thanks, Bruce. Okay, so, I'll just move on from that. So the conclusions is probably best to iterate Pema Monteith or AFib, of course, surface temperature to be used in all four components that are ingredients to the Pema Monteith. A little bit more about reference ET. There are two families in use in North America, clip grass and full cover alfalfa. Alfalfa is a little bit stronger. We tend to prefer it. ASE has taken, and FAO has taken the full Pema Monteith on the top there and then standardized it, just rolling for that reference method. We can simplify and consolidate a lot of terms, so we just have some coefficients, and here we can apply it both to the short and tall reference, same equation. And we can apply it for hourly or daily or even monthly time steps. Same equation, just different coefficients to account for time. ASCE has adopted and promoted the Pema Monteith since 1990. We did an assessment of 11 international isometer sites. Pema Monteith in almost every site came out above the more standard traditional Pema equations. Even for seasonal ET, which is very important for water rights and water transfers and hydrologic water balances, the Pema Monteith tended to hit the mark best. prior to that, one of the reasons that ASCE and FAO have advocated a single equation is with the Pema equation back in the 70s and early 80s, there were more than half a dozen different wind functions. And a lot of these we attribute to just biases in the weather data that, of course, had to create a different bias coefficient in the wind function. So it's good to move on beyond that. Just a little bit of history. In 90, actually in 74 and then again in 90, ASCE published the manuals. In 90, they advocated for the Piedmont teeth, and now just this year in 2015, ASCE has updated that manual 70 over on the right, should be on the market within a couple months. And it also recommends that the use of Piedmont teeth as a reference method. FAO took the Piedmont teeth around the globe through their number 56 paper, using it as the primary reference method and then with a host of crop coefficients. Here was an expert meeting in Rome in 1990 that kind of designed FAO 56, and I just wanted to point out Monteith and Pruitt were attending, as well as Marvin Jensen from the U.S., and then Reinder Fettes, you probably know of him, and then Alain Perrier of France, who were all present. Reasons to standardize reference ET, of course, are just for consistency just to promote a national basis. A few comparisons with measurements. Here's some sweet corn and lysimeter at Kimberley. Here's some traces of hourly ET with the Piedmont teeth and the lysimeter, and we can see some very good response even on a day when there were some clouds in the afternoon. The equation has good sensitivity. Here's for a season's worth of daily alfalfa ET at Kimberley. It's not perfect agreement on some days, just for differences in weather variation during the day, like some lysimeter, random error, but a pretty good relationship. There's a question, should we use daily versus hourly time steps? Okay, thank you. And it really, that equation can stand up and do pretty well with both of those. One last application with reference ET, we use it in some of our satellite-based remote sensing methods as a basis. I just want to introduce here, we've put our metric application on the Google Earth engine now. We call it eFlux. There's a URL at the bottom. You're welcome to explore it. It's a free access sponsored by Google. Using Landsat, we can see ET from individual fields. So that's up and running, the beta test right now. So I'm going to skip all this. Has some bushland slides from Terry Howell and Steve Ebbett. And I'll just go to the end and quit. Thank you. Sorry, I had too many slides.
Rick, have you been asked?
Yes. Yes. The question is, you know, what about net radiation with a variable canopy and soil, shaded, sunlit impacts? And that's true, and that's one reason why we advocate the use of the Piedmont teeth primarily as a reference method for a homogeneous surface, nearly homogeneous, enough that we can just assume it's a single thing. And net radiation, I think, should always be measured if it's not for that homogeneous surface, just to account for those differences. And even if, one point that ASCE and FAO both made is that even if the Piedmont teeth does not perfectly fit a measured reference, it's consistent enough and physically sensitive enough that it should become the reference anyway. It's a hypothetical reference. It's a hypothetical estimate, and we can still use it as the foundation for our crop coefficient work, and it's reproducible and transferable. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.